Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Max Kaiser, and we have a great show for you today. With us, we have Mariusz Kałczewiak, Senior Research Associate and Lecturer in the Eastern European Studies Department at the University of Potsdam. Mariusz is the author of the new book, Polakos in Argentina, Polish Jews, Interwar Migration, and the Emergence of Transatlantic Jewish Culture, published by the University of Alabama Press in 2020. So, Mariusz, thanks very much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. So, first question, how did you come to write this book?
It's a good question. It's always a hard question because I don't have kind of like a straightforward answer. I didn't have like a moment of, you know, of illumination. This is a book I need to write, but it's kind of, you know, like I would say that, you know, it's like many factors, you know, led to it. I was studying Latin American studies, so I had this kind of Latin American connection, and I was also doing Jewish studies, and it kind of, you know, it kind of like merged together and led me to study Jewish experience in Latin America. And, you know, growing up in Poland, and you know, I was always pretty much surrounded by Holocaust studies scholarship, and this was something which I didn't want to do. I wanted to do, you know, something which wasn't that much explored, something which required a certain new perspective. As you know, I wanted to study subjects which move our attention to other regions, other places of Jewish settlement, and to these chapters of Jewish history, which you know so far didn't receive, in my view, enough scholarly attention, or they did receive the attention, but after several decades. When the first book on Jewish experience in Latin America were published, I think there was a need to reevaluate our findings and to reevaluate what we know about Jews in Latin America.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question about sort of the existing historiography, because I know that you've done pretty extensive research and looking at archives and sources that are. Not ones that have been looked at before. Maybe you could kick us off by telling us a bit about your sources and about particularly the first couple of chapters that you look at are debates among Polish Jews. So at the turn of the previous century and at the debates around Argentina, and how there were conflicting images of Argentina reflected the competing interests of different sections of Polish Jewry. So maybe you could tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So you know, like when I was like conceptualizing this research and doing this let's say research design, uh, I I realized that, you know, that that history of migration, of Jewish migration, is too often written from the perspective of the new country, of the country where people immigrate to. And my kind of approach was to, you know, to bridge the realities in the home country and the realities in the new country, and do not perceive Jewish migration and emigration from Eastern Europe as something natural, as something, you know, that was, you know, always supposed to happen, as something, you know, which can be easily explained, because, you know, in my opinion, it wasn't. And this is what emerges from my sources. So as you mentioned, in the first two chapters, I kind of try to recreate debates in Jewish Poland concerning the immigration prospects. So the plans, you know, or like the, you know, the very Jewish immigration to Argentina starts around 1880s, 1890s, and this is when the discussions also start in Poland. And initially the approach in Jewish Poland concerning the possibility of immigration was received in Poland with much reservation. You know, there were many voices which were perceiving, you know, emigration to Argentina as something dangerous, as something very unsure, as something which wasn't so advisable. And we need to have in mind that from this era, like the 1880s, 1890s, we do not have many accounts of migrants themselves. I mean, like what I could recreate is the elite Jewish discourse on migration to Argentina, which happened, you know, in Polish Jewish press or in Hebrew press, and there is much caution, I'm not sure if I would say fear, but you know, in those years Argentina was perceived as not a real country, as something, you know, so far away, so unimaginable that you know, that leading Polish Jewish media outlets as Israelita or the Hebrew ones at Sfira, they were very much, you know, let's say, against. But this changes as the migration progresses, right? So I would say that, you know, that just before the World War One, the first decade of the 20th century, the migration already becomes normalized in Jewish Poland. I mean, Polish Jews and, you know, both the members of the elite and the regular folks, they just noticed, you know, people do emigrate to Argentina and establish their lives there, and in some cases, you know, some cases, you know, they are more successful, in some cases they are less successful. But I define it as a period of normalization of Jewish Argentina in the Polish Jewish eyes. So this is, I would say that this is this kind of first encounter with Argentina in Jewish Poland. I work a lot with the so-called emigration guidebooks. These were booklets written in Yiddish by you know, diverse personalities, you know, some of them were in Argentina, some of them have never been there, but kind of like, you know, compiled, you know, a body of knowledge which was supposed to be useful for those who were considering emigration. One of these books was written by a man called Jan Kefit-Vabnik, which was, you know, it appeared, you know, in several prints. I think it was printed, you know, seven or eight times, still before the World War One. And you know, also, I mean, also these guidebooks, they are ambivalent concerning Argentina. I mean, they do not present Argentina as a paradise. I mean, they kind of, you know, offer a perspective which is supposed to be, you know, informative for those who consider to immigrate, and do not paint. I mean, like, they are not using, you know, these pink glasses, or do not idealize Argentina, but kind of, you know, like, they are relatively down to earth, bordering on this kind of like cautionary tone. I'm not sure if you want me now to speak about, you know, the 1920s and 1930s. This is like the time which I focus on. In those years, you know, in those years there are some changes to concerning Polish Jewish discourse on Argentina.
Yeah, I think that would be good because obviously we've got this sort of literature that is maybe cautionary, or like you say, is not necessarily sort of doing the hard sell in terms of Argentina. Yeah. But then the way that your book opens is with this story about a man called Lazaro Pinchuk. And basically the story is that he decides to immigrate to Argentina. He's a young man, decides to immigrate to Argentina all by himself in 1923. Yeah. I guess, yeah, the question is, why did he do this, and what was the attraction, and what was the image of Argentina that suddenly became very attractive for people around this time?
Yeah, you know, like my book focuses indeed on the 1920s and 1930s, which is the highest, you know, I mean, this is the let's say the peak of the Polish Jewish immigration to Argentina, which when we have, you know, about 50-60% Jewish immigrants arriving from Poland specifically, not from other countries of the region. And, 1920s, you know, this is the time when also when the United States are, you know, reducing the immigration quotas, and mid-1920s, this is exactly the time when Argentina, you know, appears as a, you know, as a very desired destination. I mean, after US, you know, gets, you know, I mean, closes its gates basically 1923, 1924, Argentina is the first immigration destination for Eastern European Jews before Palestine, right? And indeed, you know, I mean, the story with Lazaro Pinchuk, it's my kind of like my opening story, and I think it's, you know, it's his decision to immigrate is representative for a larger portion of Polish Jews, which were, you know, there was a group of young Polish Jews who really wanted to change their life, right? And they had diverse options in interwar Poland. So, I mean, you could go in the Zionist direction, you could go in the socialist direction, you can, you know, and you could go, you could also emigrate. And this was an option which many were choosing, right? And I think so it's also important to have in mind that if someone, you know, decides to emigrate, he's a person who is questioning the tradition, right? He's not a person very much, let's say, I mean, like, he's already considering, you know, this break off from the place where he's living. So I kind of present immigration to Argentina as a part of the same social developments in Poland which are connected with the industrialization, the Jewish immigration to the urban centers, the demise of the shtetl, because when we look at the profiles like that, the class profile of the immigrants, they are not religious shtetl Jews who are migrating to Argentina in the 1920s, 1930s, right? It's already a group of people who have certain kind of like proletarian background, who are already active in certain socialist unions, let's say. They were working in factories, and this is what they are trying to recreate in Argentina, which also there we see a rise of Jewish worker unionism. We see the rise of Jewish left wing politics, and this is this kind of like transnational connection which I kind of underlined in my book, that there was a flow of people, but there was at the same time there was a flow of ideas between Jewish Poland and Jewish Argentina, and this was I wouldn't say it was in one direction, let's say, but it wasn't a mutual process, like the Argentina was usually the receiving end of influence and not the influencer, I hope this answers the question. I already forgot what was precisely the question, but I hope we are slowly getting there to the point.
No, I think that's a really good outlining of some of those central themes of the book, and how there was this sort of transnational connection, but as you say, it wasn't. There was sort of all sorts of different influences going on, and different ideas, international ideas, different movements, whether it's migration or I guess movements of ideas that were not, as you say, mutual, that there was sort of an uneven flow back and forth. Mm. So I think we'll get into it as we go through the discussion of the book. I want to move on to specifically your third chapter, and you look at in this chapter the exoticization of Argentina through an examination of travel writings. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that.
Sure. The beginning of the 20th century is a period when travel writing in general is booming, right? And especially in the context of migration, travelogues or travel narratives were something which was something very popular among Jewish reading public. So in my book, in Polacos in Argentina, I'm looking at two travelogues. One is by Perez Hirschbein, which he published in 1916, and the second one is by Hersh David Nomberg from 1924. Importantly, they were published in a book form, but they were published all earlier on. They were published in installments in Warsaw Yiddish Daily, Der Moment, and even before the publication of the book, they were providing insights on Jewish Argentina, while being there, right? And specifically concerning exotization of Argentina, I think Nomberg and Hirschbein, they were conditioned by diverse issues in when they were conceptualizing the travelogue. So on the one hand, they wanted to check, is Argentina a good country for Jews, right? And they were kind of following and trying to trace the development of Jewish schooling, of Yiddish publishing, of diversion, of Jewish infrastructures in Argentina, also specifically the Argentina's Jewish agricultural colonies, which were kind of like, you know, a landmark of the community. But at the same time, I think, you know, they were both travel writers. They were conditioned by the expectations of the readers in Eastern Europe, right? And I mean, you know, most of the people, they didn't emigrate, and most of the people didn't plan to emigrate. And what they were looking for, this was, you know, there was entertainment, right? They wanted to have a good, you know, piece of reading material. And I think this, you know, this kind of like presenting Argentina as a place which, you know, which is dangerous, which is exotic, which is so foreign, which is so far away, which is so un-Jewish and so un-Polish, which is something which is, you know, very, very much distant from the living worlds of Polish Jewish readership. It was something which was definitely attractive for them. And Hirschbein and Nomberg, they are not only travel writers. You know, as I said before, you know, there was a booming market on this kind of narratives in Poland, 1920s, 1930s. And I'm discussing, you know, the travelogues of Hirschbein and Nomberg also in the context of, let's say, general, including non-Jewish travel writing. And I'm like trying to understand to what extent, you know, Eastern European Jewish travel writer is similar or different to French or British travel writer. And I come to conclusion that they are, you know, their position is very ambivalent, right? So on the one hand, they have, you know, they have these certain traces of white supremacism. I mean, they perceive themselves as members of the elite, let's say. I mean, they are members of the cultural elite. I mean, maybe not in the, let's say, in France or in Britain, but definitely in the Yiddish land. And but on the other hand, they do not have this approach which links them with any empire, right? They do not have this approach of that, you know, their travel writing needs to kind of be linked with any imperial project, because, you know, because Jews weren't a colonial nation. And so I mean, you find very exoticizing, you know, paragraphs, you know, about like red Indians and they being so, you know, so hot-blooded and very, you know, or dangerous, or, you know, like being, you know, being able to kill you for no reason. And the same happens, you know, with Argentine nature. You know, the nature is, you know, is pictured in both texts as something very perilous, as something very, you know, as something which the Jewish agricultural settlers they need to subdue, right? That's something which is, you know, which is like so powerful and so uncontrollable that it really requires a major effort on the side of the Jewish settlers, and I think, you know, I think this aspect of the narrative is to a certain extent similar to Zionist accounts of, you know, of like conquering Palestine in this kind of like terms of nature, right? You know, of like, you know, drying the wetlands and so on and so forth. So both Nomberg and Hirschbein kind of give an account of immense Jewish effort to establish the new lives as farmers in Argentina, and, you know, despite all obstacles and despite this unfriendly conditions which they face.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I guess it makes me think about also Jewish and Yiddish discourse in Australia as well, where you had that sort of, I guess, settler colonial discourse around exoticizing or treating indigenous people as inferior, and also, you know, exoticizing sort of nature, and that it was sort of an enemy to be conquered. And so there's some really interesting common themes there. So, yeah, we talked about sort of how these travel writers exoticized Argentina, and we sort of touched on it, but I'd like to go a bit more into it. Is this idea of Yiddish land that you talk about? So maybe tell us a bit more about what you mean by Yiddish land, and tell us about how Argentina was a part of it.
Yeah, thanks. Well, you know, like one of the arguments which I kind of, you know, like suggest in this book, that, you know, that that the Jewish migration from Eastern Europe to Argentina extended what I call the Yiddish land, which is the, you know, let's say the cultural space of Eastern European Jewishness, where, you know, where Yiddish is the language of education, of institutions, of theater, of other, I mean, like of different, you know, social and cultural infrastructures. And you know, I think, I mean, there are two aspects which I think I would like to mention today. So one of them is that, you know, that I suggest that, you know, that Yiddishism kind of, like, I mean, Yiddishism understood as a movement, as a, you know, like powerful language movement, and, you know, as which sees Yiddish language as a major feature of Ashkenazi Eastern European Jewishness, that it also immigrated to Argentina, and, you know, it found, you know, a fruitful ground in Argentina, and kind of, you know, experienced a period of blooming, which wasn't exactly perceived as such everywhere. So you know, for Argentine Yiddish activists, it was very, very important that their efforts, you know, in literature, in you know, in theater, in education, Yiddish education, that they would be recognized in other major centers of the Yiddish land, meaning, you know, in Eastern Europe and in the United States, right? So, you know, no, I mean, from Eastern European perspective, all Yiddish things which happened in Argentina, they were peripheral and marginal. They weren't on the same level as you know, as what was going on in Poland, let's say in the 1920s, when this was the major center of Yiddish culture, right? So for Argentine activists, it was always very important, you know, to present themselves, to cast themselves as you know, as a new branch of Yiddish land, something which, you know, which grew from scratch, you know, that there was nothing, and now we managed to, we were successful in building all this Yiddish life, right? And they weren't, you know, exaggerating, you know, let's say concerning Yiddish media, right? They were They were, just to mention that the two main Yiddish daily newspapers, Die Presse and the Yiddische Zeitung, they were highly influential on Jewish street in Argentina, and they were really read by most of Argentine Jews, also concerning the Yiddish schooling. I would say that, you know, that Argentina was relatively successful in establishing, you know, all these Yiddish infrastructures, but still, you know, the level of recognition from other centers, there was something which was always on the agenda. So at times the Eastern Europe, Argentine Jews were traveling to Eastern Europe, for instance, for the conference of the Ivo Institute. I mean, just to be there, just to be connected, right? Just to show, you know, Argentine Jewish, just to show the vitality of Argentine Jewish or Argentine Yiddish life in the Eastern European center. And you know, I think in one of the chapters I look at the Warsaw Literary Weekly, Literarische Blätter, which was a kind of like a elite highbrow literary journal, and I suggest that this was like the only source in Poland which gave Argentina, Jewish Argentina, this recognition which it kind of requested, right? Which, I mean, Literarische Blätter, you know, featured articles on Argentinian Yiddish writers. They printed, you know, printed like a full Argentine Yiddish issue of Literarische Blätter. But still, this was something unique. So, you know, if we speak about the, you know, broader discussions in Jewish Poland on Argentina 1920s, 1930s, I mean, it's still this, like, the major context, you know, it's emigration and women trafficking, which I guess we'll speak about it, you know, later on to some extent, and the interest, you know, in what is Jewish Argentina doing, you know, in the terms of literature or journalism, it wasn't raising much interest in Poland.
I think that you sort of towards the end of the book you turn more towards looking at Argentine mm-hmm. Jewish identity and I guess how the negotiation of this identity was influenced by that diasporic Yiddish agenda. So maybe you could tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, sure. On one side we have this what you just called, you know, this like international Yiddish agenda, and on the other hand we have Argentine nationalism and Argentine belonging, right? So these are kind of, you know, like two competing powers which are kind of and Jews in Argentina they find themselves somewhere between those powers, and they need to negotiate, you know, if they go more into now this let's say Argentine national erection, or they maintain interest and loyalties in this kind of like Yiddish links with other parts of the world. I think we shouldn't think about these two options as black and white. And I think, you know, most of the people they were in a kind of like a gray zone. But, you know, they were able, you know, both to develop a very strong identity attachment to Argentina, but at the same time, you know, maintain this sense of obligation, or like the sense of to maintain Jewish Poland as, you know, as a major reference point, you know, in terms of who they are. So, you know, one of the when you look at the first generation of migrants, I mean those who migrated relatively early, meaning you know the last decade of the 19th century, the first decade of the 20th century, this generation of people, especially children, they grew up in a kind of like nationalist discourse, which was very strong in Argentina around 1910, which was the 100th anniversary of Argentine independence. And in those years, this kind of, you know, melting pot ideology was very much dominant in Argentine politics and society, and the immigrants were very much requested to as soon as possible to become Argentine and to kind of, you know, eliminate the links with the countries of origins. I mean, this is another question if they were successful or not. But these years, you know, these are years, for instance, when we're in schooling, when the immigrant kids are very much like brought up in this kind of like Argentine nationalist spirit. And this is, you know, this is also something which happens with Jewish immigrants, and you know, like also adopting Spanish as the first language, and this is what leads us, you know, to emergence in the second decade of the 20th century major Jewish Argentine institutions of this kind of like acculturated group within Argentine Jewry. So we have the Sociedad Hebraica Argentina, which was kind of like grouping this kind of, you know, young Jews who were fluent in Spanish and very much connected to Argentina. They felt first and foremost as Argentines. The Jewishness was something at the background, right? A form of identification was as Argentines, and they also established the newspapers and so on and so forth. And what I suggest, you know, that in the 1920s, when there is a second wave of Polish Jewish immigration, that when we have a generation of people who grew up in Poland with Yiddish schooling, who grew up with Yiddish press, which wasn't the case, you know, 20 years earlier, right? So, you know, at the very beginning of the 20th century, there was no free Jewish press in Russian Empire. So this happens only later, right? So those who immigrated in the 1920s, they kind of, you know, bring new ideas about Jewishness. They bring new concepts, you know, both in politics and concerning the language policies, and this is what I call re-Yiddishization of Jewish Argentina. So we have this group of children of the first immigrants, the end of the 19th century, which I call Israelitas Argentinos, like Jewish Argentines. And we have the new group of immigrants, which kind of, you know, bring new ideas, and they are very much influential. They do not believe that, you know, that Yiddish language is inferior to Spanish. They do not believe that the cultural expression of Argentine Jews should be in Spanish exclusively. And I think, you know, in the 1920s, they really gained the upper hand in Argentine Jewish world in the 1920s, and this of course changes in the 1930s, where they themselves Argentinize, and they themselves, you know, become, you know, more linked to the Spanish speaking surrounding, But still, you know, they maintain diverse forms of links with Jewish Poland, which is for instance fundraising for diverse causes in Poland, or organizing, you know, protests, kind of like organizing protests against anti-Semitism in Poland.
Yeah, very interesting. So along that theme, part of what you look at in the last few chapters is Argentine landsman history.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a bit about what that is, first of all. What is a landsman? Yeah. And what was the role of landsman organizations mm-hmm. in engendering ethnic identities in Argentina?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, so, you know, like landsmanschaft, and these are unions or societies grouping Jews coming from the same time from the same town or from the same region, and they were established, you know, they were established in most of countries of Jewish immigration, you know, including United States, Argentina, South Africa, I'm sure Australia as well, Israel. And you know, usually Landsmannschaften are known to many people as kind of like producers of ethnic memory in the form of Jewish memorial books, the Iskolbücher, which were published after Holocaust as a kind of, you know, kind of like a mutual effort to commemorate the destroyed Jewish communities. And my approach was, you know, kind of, you know, to look, you know, deeper in the Landsmann history, and kind of like focus on their activities before the Holocaust. I mean, to focus on the activities in the period of immigration. So, and of course, you know, Landsmannschaften is not something, you know, the name is a Yiddish name, but this kind of, you know, like mutual support organization or societies, this was something common for any group of immigrants. So in Argentina in those years we have analogous organizations organized by Italians, by Spaniards, by Poles, etc. So in the first period, just after the people immigrated, they got together kind of, you know, to create this networks of mutual support. So, you know, in those years we do not have any kind of, you know, like pension plans, we do not have insurances, we do not have any like state organized support for people. So they were organizing, you know, they were offering free loans for new immigrants to establish their businesses. They were offering assistance for people who were unemployed, and or like medical assistance, right? And this is the first period of Landsman history, which in Argentine case it's the second decade of the 20th century. And afterwards, you know, when the migrants, they are, you know, they are more and more successful in Argentina, when they are growing from peddlers into you know, let's say middle-sized factory owners or workshop owners, or in some cases clerks. I mean, then I suggest that the role of Landsmannschaften is changing, and it's transforming in very different direction. And in those years, I think Landsmannschaften, they are like as a place of ethnic empowerment as Polish Jews, right? So I work with the biggest Landsmannschaft in Argentina, which was Polish Jewish Verein, Verband, and Polish Jewish Union in Argentina, and I look at the newspapers. I mean, they were producing their own journals. I look at the protocols of the meetings. I look at the events they organized. So If you look, for instance, at the cultural aspect, so, you know, the picnics which they organized. I mean, those meetings were, you know, I mean, they were organized. They were kind of like projecting the middle class aspirations, because like picnics, it was, you know, with orchestra and music, etc. You know, like leisure activities. This was something which Argentine middle class was, you know, was performing in the 1920s, 1930s, in order to kind of like voice the belonging to the middle class. But at the same time, the meetings were just, I mean, they were organized in an exclusively Polish-Jewish setting, right? Only Polish Jews and their wives and their children, they were there. And this was kind of, you know, like a space for like fostering the sense of community and also kind of, you know, underlining the achievement in Argentina as Polish Jews, right? So you know, this is something which becomes very, very visible in these fundraising campaigns which I mentioned earlier. So in the 1930s, Argentine Jews organized fundraising campaigns in order to support certain initiatives in Jewish Poland, which they identify. It could mean Yiddish secular schooling. It could mean the YIVO Institute in Vilna, and they kind of, you know, they kind of perceive those centers in Poland as hallmarks, as the major you know achievements of Polish Jews, and they, as Polish Jews in Argentina, they feel responsible for supporting and maintaining these institutions, and in order to do so, they indeed organize like large scale fundraising campaigns. It's of course not only the Polisher Verband which is doing it, but it always the members of the Polisher Verband were the leaders of the these fundraising campaigns. So on the one hand, we have this like kind of like support for this Jewish initiatives in Poland with which they identify, but at the same time we have the campaigns, the fundraising campaigns, they were you know, they were organized in order to showcase the economic success in Argentina, success, right? So I mean, you know, it was kind of, you know, to show themselves and to show other Argentines and to show Polish Jews, look, we are Polish Jews, we are successful, and we, with our Argentine money, we support the YIVO Institute in Vilna, or we support the Cisza secular schools in Poland because we are Polish Jews and because we maintain you know, this sense of responsibility, let's say.
That is all very interesting. We're coming to the end of our interview today. So before I get you to tell us a bit more about what your next project is or what you're working on, is there anything else that you want to cover off that we haven't about this book, about Polacos in Argentina?
I think we have managed to cover, you know, basically the main points. I think so. Yeah.
I think so. So yeah, that's a really good preview for the listeners and potential readers. Thoroughly recommend having a read of the book. So yes, before we do let you go, Mariusz, can you tell us a bit about what you're working on next?
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of in a. I'm doing, you know, a project which is not connected with Latin America. I'm now working on my second book project, which looks at gender relations and specifically at Polish Jewish masculinities, 1890s, 1930s. And kind of, you know, like offers like a, you know, a broad perspective on Jewish men in Poland. I mean, like so far, you know, we have seen these studies which looked at the masculinity in the context of Zionism and the new Jewish man, or we had this important book of Bujarin on kind of, you know, like gentle orthodox masculinity. And I think, you know, these two opposing visions, they are not exactly representing the lived reality in Poland. And I think that as in the case of Jews in Argentina, the gray zone was always the biggest fragment of the fragment of the social reality. So I'm looking at diverse aspects of building building male gender roles. So I'm looking at the Jewish fraternities at universities in Kraków and in Lviv. I'm looking at the debates concerning the circumcision in Poland. I'm looking at the yeshiva masculinity. I mean, this is what I'm working on now. As I said, I'm kind of in the middle of this project, so I think it will still take about 2 years to be able to present it to the readers.
Okay, great. Well, we'll have to book you in for 2 years' time to come back to New Books in Jewish Studies, because that sounds like a really great and interesting book project. But that's all we have time for today. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk with you, and thank you again for inviting me.